copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
Let's look at some beliefs that could well crop up here or amongst our friends, people we know. 22-year-old atheist student attends an Is God Dead debate organized by the Christian Union and after further discussions becomes a convinced believer. This person is thinking their way into faith on the face of it. A 44-year-old Roma woman, after talking to a Christian friend, comes to believe that everyday events and coincidences have special significance from God for her. And she's so captivated by these sense of special significance of events for her that she converts to Christianity. So this is a very different route in. 65-year-old agnostic university professor's wife is ill and he prays for healing. She dies, but after a powerful emotional experience of God's presence, he develops a firm and enduring trust in God. Now, I just mentioned those examples as a reminder that the route into faith and then subsequently the way our beliefs are experienced and are developed and form our characters and personality takes different pathways in different people. And even in these three examples, we see a variety of religious experiences being presented to us. But it turns out if we look more generally at people's sort of religious experiences, these kind of events and the belief in the supernatural, that there is a reality beyond what is immediately perceived, those beliefs are much more common than what might be led to think. There's maybe not, these examples aren't quite as unique as we thought. I mean, for example, this is a Comres poll for Theos think tank just carried out 2 years ago in London. And this is a general population study. 77% of people in the general population agree that life cannot be explained through science or other means. 59% believe in spiritual beings, which is quite surprising. 76% believe in spiritual realms. 39% have undergone tarot card reading, star signs, and 55% of people pray sometimes. So it turns out that spiritualities, in that very broad sense, a belief in and sense of sometimes experience of a reality beyond the senses is much more commonly distributed in human populations and human culture than on the face of it we might suppose. And indeed, in with the dawn of the new atheism, there's actually very little suggests that these beliefs are declining in prevalence. In fact, in these Gallup polls in the States, this is belief in hauntings and belief in ghosts, two broadly comparable polls taken 1990 and 2001, even allowing some sampling variations, you can see that the proportion of people who assent to these beliefs actually increases over that 10-year period when new atheism is getting underway. So there's very little to suggest that these beliefs, senses are declining in the general population. So the question that I want us to set ourselves today is this. Have the neurosciences explained why human beings are so incurably spiritual? Because it does seem that we are incurably spiritual. There's something about being human that goes with being spiritual, sensing, believing that there's a world beyond our immediate senses. And one possibility, I mean, the possibility we'd all default to is that we are made in the image of God and therefore It is in our very nature to seek him. But could it be that the neurosciences have come up with an alternative explanation? Because if that's the case, and I'm going to suggest to you it is, then we need to be aware of it if we're to engage with this narrative apologetically. And the notion that the neurosciences may think they've come up with an explanation comes from headlines such as this: "The God Spot Revealed. Scientists find area of the brain responsible for spirituality." And this is in the Daily Mail in England, 2012. And here we've got on the face of it a claim. If you read the story a little more closely, it doesn't quite stack up with the headline. But we've got the claim that neuroscience has discovered a spot in your brain, and it's possible that you're all here because you've got an extra big spot. And that this spot is responsible for our spiritual interests and has developed there maybe through evolutionary mechanisms for some reasons that we have yet to work out. But there's been quite a lot of excitement about the notion that with brain imaging, we can locate and visualize aspects of spiritual experience. And that is the case. And there's no doubt that there are areas of the brain which become active in certain spiritual activities. Okay? And the two arguments, really, that come from the neurosciences that we need to know about is, first of all, that spirituality is explained by areas in the brain that are generating, that are responsible for, and therefore generating these spiritual interests. And that is based on the premise that location equals causation. Because we've located an activity in the brain, we have explained it in terms of its causal power. There's an alternative narrative around, which I'm going to come on to second. And that's that the location is less important than the function. There's another narrative out there in the neurosciences, which is, no, we're not so interested in the fact that spiritual activity can be sort of seen in areas of the brain, but we are interested in the way that the brain more generally seems to function in ways that prime us, predispose us to be spiritual beings. All right? Now, it's in that second area that I think there's much greater interest. And I want to sort of dispatch with this area fairly quickly. Because, of course, just because we can visualize a particular activity in the brain does not mean that we've explained it. All it means is that we have visualized it, we have imaged it, we have seen it and found ways of representing that activity. And if we just look into this a little more, well, here's the angular gyrus, and this little bit of the brain seems to become more active when we have out-of-body type of experiences. And this experience is on a spectrum. At the milder end, there's a phenomenon called depersonalization. And what I'm sure some of you will have experienced this. It's that strange feeling of suddenly that you're not in your body. Anybody had this? That you're looking down on yourself almost, that you're somehow slightly detached from yourself. You've had that, Val. Anybody else had this where you're not real, you're not here? Yes, you've had. If all these people see me afterwards, and then we'll have a consultation. But this part of the brain seems to become active then, and people who have intense out-of-body experiences, this seems to be very active. And so we could conjecture, for example, because we've discovered this to be true, that the Apostle Paul, when he talked of being caught up into the third heaven, if you remember in Scripture, that what was happening was that his angular gyrus was becoming more active and generating for him the experience, but in fact it was had no reality. And here's a different kind of work that's gone on. Here we've got prayer scans, and what we find here is when people are praying, particularly what we might call evangelical prayers, which are very verbal and laden with language, then those parts of the brain that we use when we're speaking light up. Now, why people think this is of any interest, I don't know, but they do. And they think, ah, yes, look, the language center's lighting up when we pray. But this is the kind of thing that's often sort of highlighted, particularly in popular newspapers. Who's this? Oh, it's the Dalai Lama. Now, what's the Dalai Lama doing peering into an MRI scanner? Well, he and other Buddhists are quite interested in the way that you can image the effects of meditation, a very different kind of prayer, in brain activity. And in fact, we all have something called the amygdala here, which is at the frontal end of our temporal lobes, round about in there. And when we get fed up of that person who cut us parking and we slam on our brakes and we stick and we get out of the car and we march up, that our amygdala is firing up then. It's the volatile, very reactive part of our brains. And it's particularly reactive in teenagers. And then we, as they enter into the maturity of adulthood, it begins to settle down. And people who undergo courses of meditation, their amygdala quietens, and you can see how the amygdala becomes less reactive visually on scanning, functional MRI scanning, as people develop deeper meditative exercises. And there's a switch of balance between the right and left side of the frontal lobes, which tends to happen as we get less anxious as well. And these are long-term changes. These changes, once people have been meditating for a while, are quite observable. And these and other examples I could give you begin to illustrate that there isn't a God spot. There are numerous areas of brain activity which can be measured or seen or visualized when we engage in spiritual activities. It turns out that God is everywhere in the brain. Because, of course, spiritual activity is a holistic activity. Sometimes it involves verbal prayer at others, contemplative prayer. It involves sometimes intense emotional engagement, sense of being out of yourself and lost. All of these experiences we would expect to be reflected in brain activity if they are taking place in people with brains. And any kind of significance that's attached to this depends on the notion that causation, rather location, equals causation. Because you've located something, that you've discovered the cause. Anybody who knows anything about neuroscience now will tell you that is a fallacy. Because the brain, we know, is much more plastic than used to be understood to be the case. And the brain reacts to its environment as much as engages our response with our environment. And of course, the classic example of this is the London taxi driver experiment. That was one of the first experiments that captured people's imagination. It's about 12 years old now. But at Queen's Square in London, they took a group of London taxi drivers, put them through scanners, and found that a bit of the brain called the posterior inferior parahippocampal gyrus, way at the back here, it's located in there, which is particularly active when we're reading maps and when we're developing spatial concepts in our brain. When we're visualizing which way to get down to get our supper tonight, on the third floor we need to go down. You know, whenever we do that, it's that part of the brain that becomes more active. And it's terribly interesting because they found that if you compare London taxi drivers with controls, that part of the brain is bigger, it's larger, and more active. And so, location equals causation. That means that people with big parahippocampal posterior bits are going to become taxi drivers, you see, if that's true. But here's the thing. They found that the size of the difference compared with controls was in linear relationship with the length of time they'd been taxi driving. So the longer you're taxi driving, the bigger that bit of the brain seems to be in comparison with controls. And so this was one of the early studies which seemed to be validating lots of emerging data that the brain is plastic, it responds to our environment, and indeed how we ourselves engage with our environment and the choices we make about our environment as much as determines how we respond. It's an interactive relationship. And brain imaging has done nothing to untangle the age-old question of the relationship between mind and body. And so with the dismantling of the notion of location equals causation, any threat to faith that this is somehow generated in these areas of the brain is dismantled as well. Because we would expect any spiritual activity to be reflected in the brains of those who experience it. And in the same way that driving around the streets of London can shape my brain, so God himself and my encounter with him contextually and directly in the Holy Spirit. There's no reason scientifically why those changes in our brain as we respond to him or our environment of his presence, there's no reason why they shouldn't be reflected in the brain. So nothing's proved here. So really, we don't need to spend too long on this first challenge to us that because we've located spiritual activity, we've explained it. All we've done is characterized it in a little more detail. Okay? Yeah, déjà vu, poorly understood. It seems to be a quirk, a trick that the brain slips into for reasons that we don't understand. I think that's the easiest bottom line. The speculation, but nobody really knows. But again, déjà vu can be an intense experience. It's on a spectrum and it can be really intense for some people. And I think it's best explained as we're in a fallen world, the brain isn't working perfectly. We know that the brain makes perceptual errors in many different kinds of ways. For example, I was waking up one morning and I heard a voice saying Glyn, which is my name. And I heard it through my ears in external space. And I sat bolt upright because I knew I hadn't imagined it. I heard it in external space through my ears. This is what we spend our lives as psychiatrists, talking to people very carefully that this was what we call a true auditory hallucination. And I had one. And I thought, that's very interesting. That's a hypnopompic hallucination. And a hypnopompic hallucination is the kind of hallucination that occurs in about 10% of people at some point in their lives, 10-15% even, or a hypnagogic just as you're falling off to sleep, hypnopompics just as you've woken up, hypnagogics just as you're falling, and hearing a voice calling out your name is very common. And no one understands quite why it works except that the most economical explanation is the brain's making a mistake. And what we do know, for example, is that people who have a lot of auditory hallucinations, the auditory reception center in the brain is right next to the verbal generation center. In other words, the bit that makes words is very close to the bit that hears voices, that hears my voice now in the brain. And people who are quite ill with auditory hallucinations, hearing hallucinations, you can visualize how the verbal center lights up just before the auditory center. So when they hear a voice, the auditory center really hears lights up. They hear the voice, just as you're hearing mine now, but it's actually occurring because of a kind of a leakage from their own verbal language generation center. Now, it isn't difficult to suppose that, most things are distributed normally in the population, that there are people who aren't really ill, but who nevertheless, the brain makes some errors of interpretation as it goes down into sleep or as it wakes up. These are big changes taking place in the brain at those two periods. It makes some errors. It misinterprets, or there's a leakage of information from one compartment to another. That would be my most economic explanation. Now, you'd say, oh, well, this is interesting now, because maybe Samuel... Is that what you're going to say?
Yeah.
Maybe Samuel, when he heard the Lord saying, Samuel, he was having a hypnopompic hallucination, you know? That's a plausible explanation, you see. If you go back and look at the story of Samuel, of course, Samuel gets up, he's quite subtle, goes to see Eli. Eli sends him away. He goes back. He hears the voice again. Goes to see Eli. He comes back. He hears the voice again. He goes to see Eli, and Eli says, you know, the Lord has called you. And he goes back, and he has a much longer conversation with the Lord. We're not talking about hypnopompic hallucinations now. We're talking about either frank mental illness, or we're talking about a supernatural intervention. Okay? Now, what I suggest to you is the fact that we have brain scanning doesn't particularly help with resolving that dilemma. People 100 years ago knew about madness and had the same question. Was Samuel hearing voices like those people in Bethlehem Asylum? Was he mad? You know, what you have to do is you take in all the evidence, just as any psychiatrist does. You know, is this person something going on here? What are the other signs of mental illness? And what we know about Samuel's subsequent development, there's no suggestion that he had a schizophrenic illness or any of these psychotic disorders. So the hypothesis that his hearing a voice was hypnopompic hallucination is a weak one because of subsequent events. The hypothesis that he's got a severe mental illness, it's a pretty weak one, given what else we know about this. But we could have arrived at that solution without imaging what was going on in his brain at the time. So it's very interesting how brain imaging is a very limited value in resolving these issues. Sometimes people who have experiences that simulate the brain in the form, say, of epilepsy, it can give such a profound recasting of the world of experience that it does lead them into a deeper spirituality. I mean, that does happen. Sometimes people on drugs, similarly, who have particular trips, you know, it awakens them to say, I know it was only the drug that did that, but wow, that I connected with something there and I need to explore it more, you see. But that aside, I think I'd want to argue that when we say a spiritual experience, what do you mean? We mean some intense feeling or some way of thinking that seems to come on us, or some connection, some realization. If you experience it, your brain experiences it. So there's no, I would expect if you then stimulate that same bit of the brain half an hour later, it shouldn't be difficult to mimic what you just experienced. But the first one, it was the Holy Spirit. The second one, it was you with your little tweezers. Do you see what I mean? So it doesn't invalidate the work of the Holy Spirit, that he works through our brains, because that's where our experiences are. You may want to challenge that. I'm going to move on, otherwise, but come back a bit later. I think of more interest than this location issue is the question of the way the brain works more functionally. This is more the functional argument. Does the brain work in ways that predispose us to believe in the supernatural? That's the question. This is the more interesting pushback that comes from the neurosciences. It's not whether the brain has spots in it that make us... Does the whole brain seem to work in ways that perhaps predisposes us to these spiritual beliefs? Now, what do we mean by that? Well, first of all, let's remind ourselves just how common the world of belief in a reality beyond senses is. You know, 4% of houses... in England, 4% estate agents I saw estimate that houses number 13 go for about 4 or 5% less than market value than other houses. How many hotels have you been on? No 13th floor. 20% of streets in England have no number 13. People say, oh, it's nonsense, we don't believe this, but they still don't have number 13 on their house. And so there is something about being human that leads us into these supranatural, supersensory sort of inferences about the world. And it's not just ordinary folk like you and I. This is President Obama, and here he is playing basketball with one of his aides. And his aide wrote, he played ball on the morning of the Iowa caucuses and won. He skipped playing ball in New Hampshire and Nevada and lost. Was there a connection? He said, we've played every primary day since, you see. So there you've got the President of the United States who plays basketball because he thinks that it's going to help him become President of the United States, the candidate. Of course, he doesn't really believe it. If you press him at a rational level, he says, of course I don't believe that. But his behavior told us otherwise. And similarly, as human beings, we seem to be disposed to behave non-rationally, to make connections that logically are hard to justify, to make inferences that if we sat down in the cold light of day, we'd probably say no, but still we behave with a yes. And so we're back to this question of why are we so incurably spiritual and spooky and looking for meanings and connections? Well, it might be, say the neurosciences, simply because the brain has evolved to work in that way. In three particular areas, okay? First, let's just get our number 13s out of the way. We seem to be primed for seeing patterns. The brain works in ways that searches for patterns. The brain isn't a blank slate that works out eventually that there's a pattern there. The moment that went up, your brain worked out that there's a triangle in there. And indeed, if we were to put you into a scanner, we'd discover that your brain is filling in these lines. There are actual representation of those lines in your brain with what's an illusion. And there are lots of these kind of studies which show that we are pattern seeking. It's a top-down process, that we are looking for patterns. The brain is primed to see coherence and connections between things in the world. And this seems to be distributed somewhat asymmetrically between the right and left hemispheres of the brain. For example, here, what was the first thing you saw? First thing you saw? H4, yeah. You say, well, it's bigger, obviously. But interestingly, if you had autism or then the Asperger's syndrome, the severe end, you'd more likely be thinking, isn't that funny, all those E's? And here we've got eights. And that's consistent now that I look back, because these E's make up an H. And yes, that's interesting. These eights are actually a bigger numeral as well. So it isn't that the eights are part of an alphabetical figure. That's really interesting. It's the alphabet part of it. Do you see, the person with autism is working from the detail outwards. Most people without autism work from the big pattern inwards. And the reason for this is that people who struggle with autism have a much more compromised right brain. And it's the right brain that takes in these big pictures. It's a value of, now this is very simplistic and we mustn't overdo right left brain. But in general, it's a value of the right hemisphere to orientate to the world in a way that looks for the big picture, the pattern. It's a value of the left side of the brain's function to then interrogate what it sees for the detail of it. And then as the left brain says, oh yes, I see there's E's and there's eights, the left brain then returns that detail to the right brain, which integrates the whole into a H4 pattern made up of E's on the left and 8's on the right to complete the picture. So it's very interesting the way that this orientation to the world in this pattern-seeking way can be understood as being asymmetric in the way the brain works. But it certainly underscores this propensity we have for searching for patterns. So that's the first thing we know about the way the brain works. It is primed as a pattern-seeking, for pattern-seeking. Second, it's primed relation. It's primed to seek relationships. And some of this connects with the patterns, actually. I mean, if you look at this one on the right, what do you see in that random pattern of dots and things? Dashes. Right. I mean, these are all examples. The majority of people will see, because I think that is built into that, a Saturn-like, you know, planet-type thing. That's what most people see. And then you have a few outliers who see interesting other things, you know, and that's just a normal distribution of the way we... But what we hold in common is a desire to pull something out of what could otherwise be random. Now, this is a more difficult one. What do you see on the... And this one was, yeah, go on. What do you see in that one? The one on the right is generated to create an image. You know, they're wanting us to see something in there. So it's not a random pattern. This is simply a computer-generated random pattern. There is nothing planned there by any sort of human agency. So what anything that we see there is our brain searching very hard. And only a smaller proportion of people actually see anything all that convincing. And in here, you see, there's much less interaction with this, wasn't there? Anyway, the point of the experiment is actually different. The point is that, looking at the one on the left, a group of subjects were asked to do what I've just asked you to do. And the vast majority didn't see anything, as the vast majority of you didn't see anything. They were then completed that experiment, and they were moved to another experiment. This experiment was a trick intervention. They were given a straightforward sort of personality test, and then at the end they were debriefed, and a selection of those subjects were told that the personality test was a predictor, and it was turned out to be quite an accurate predictor of future relationships and how lonely you're likely to be in your older age. Okay? And so a proportion of the group were told, sadly, do you really want to know? Well, you know, it says that you are going to be lonely in your old age. And so anyway, thank you very much. That test has finished. And then they say, before you go, we just want to retest this one, and they link it with some unrelated issue, you see, because we're now doing retesting after 25, a half an hour to see whether there's any change. See? And they tried to trick them into thinking this was nothing to do with what they just had, the personality test. Okay? This time round, significantly more people see images, patterns in that. You see, and what do they see? Those who've been told that they're going to be lonely are significantly more likely to see anthropomorphic images, faces, eyes, noses, people. And this was quite a nice controlled study, which confirms that our brains are not only primed to seek patterns, but we are particularly primed to look for patterns that draw us into relationships, that represent relationships. And what's even more interesting is that this pattern seeking, or rather this relational seeking, is precognitive. It's part of the way our brain works before it gets language. What makes me say that? These are, if you put babies less than in the first hour of life, just popped out into the world, they have no language, no concepts. The world is a strange and fascinating place, but there's no language by which to evaluate it. You put them into a condition where you can measure their eye movements, And the question is, do they tend to drift from left to right or right to left? Significantly, newborn infants' eyes move from that to that direction. They're drawn to the face. They don't know what a face is. They've got no language, no words. No symbols of the world have been formed yet. And yet they come into the world with a brain that is primed to see relationship, particularly a very significant relationship who will be their mum. It's very interesting that we come into the world, the brain is already working in this relation-seeking way. So that's the second area in which the brain seems to function in certain ways that I'm going to suggest in a little while. Neuroscientists say, explain religion. Okay? And the third one is we seem to be primed as design seekers, not just pattern seekers, but design seekers in the world. And I'm going to, just for time's sake, keep moving here, but Deborah Kellerman is the great doyenne of this area of research. She calls children up until the age of five, six, she says they are promiscuous teleologists. Lovely term. Promiscuous teleologists. Children want to see a causal chain everywhere. So why are mountains pointy would be an example. Children would tend to explain that in terms of some designed, inherent design. It's so that giants can't sit on them. You see, there's a reason for it. Now, as we get older, we are taught more mechanical explanations. It's because with the weathering of the rock, bits of rock fall away. And you see, that's not a designed explanation. That's just a mechanical explanation. The weather causes the rock to fall away and it appears sharp. Children, though, instinctively see purpose and design. And there are a number of experiments she has to show how this design seeing aspect of the brain tends to be overridden in adult years, but actually it's still there underneath. And if we have to make judgments very quickly, if our judgments are speeded up, we start to go back to those primitive design searching judgments. So what we're building up is a picture of the brain as an organ that is primed for patterns, relationships, design. Why might that be? Neuroscience would say it's because all of those have been developed through evolutionary mechanisms because they have survival advantage. And it's not hard to see how that develops, is it? And you think, well, I can see the survival advantage of relationships because if I'm primed to look for eyes and a face, I turn to my mother. My mother is the source of nourishment. And so it's not surprising that this has been selected out and strengthened, the face-seeking behavior of an infant. Okay, so you see, I think I could get that. What about patterns, though? In what sense do seeing patterns have evolutionary value, of survival value? Well, according to evolutionary theory, if you see patterns, you're more likely to escape danger. And it doesn't matter that 99% of the time when you spot a pattern, you are wrong. You just need to get it right once to justify those 99 times. In other words, in survival terms, false positives are quite sustainable, provided they protect you from false negatives. So the tiger example is a good example. How does this work? I'm an animal in the bushes. The bushes move. I see the pattern and I jump to the conclusion that a tiger's going to get me and jump out. In other words, not only is there a pattern, there's a sort of a causal link there, a design factor. And, you know, grass moves in the wind. 999 times it was just the wind blowing, but I just need it for that thousandth time to get out of the way of the tiger when there's really a tiger, for that pattern of behavior to confer on me survival value. And I would say that that is a perfectly plausible explanation. I think it's internally consistent, it's plausible with other consistent with other evidence for evolution. It seems to be a plausible hypothesis. What do you think? Here's a baboon. The baboon is posted by the others on the edge of the troop as a lookout. As a lookout, he is primed to seek patterns. And not only does that pattern recognition protect him, it protects the soup, the troop as a whole. So he confers group survival onto his particular troop. But also, the relationship-seeking aspects of the brain enable the troop to work cooperatively. And so that strengthens the relationship aspect as well. And then eventually, they'll allow him in to take his share of the meat whilst the rest, somebody else is posted to look out, you see? And so we see how these patterns, relationships, design even at a very primitive level can confer survival value. And we have a hypothesis, and that is the hypothesis that comes from neuroscience, that in a way our religious beliefs are the price we pay for these brain predispositions. So you're going down the street, you pray for a parking space. Whoa, there's a parking space. You forget the 999 times there wasn't one. You erase the fact when you got a parking ticket. You remember this one. Because you went into church and you gave your testimony. You say, I came and I was late and I prayed for a parking space and God gave me one. And you get clapped and it makes you feel good. And so it confers on that kind of behavior a reward. And it makes us feel we're being spiritual, and so it has relational value, you see. So you see how this thing can go on, and so if I just try and similarly here, our relationship seeking spirituality is just the price we pay, say neurosciences, for the brain working in this way, seeing connections, thinking there's a God, believing in a designer. It's all explainable. And I'm quite happy to concede that that is a plausible, internally consistent hypothesis. My only problem with it, and this is it, Christian spiritual experiences share the same brain regional activity with other spiritual experience. Christian faith is just another example of over-enthusiastic meaning-making. Plausible hypothesis. My only problem with it is this, friends. I think it's what I call a thin hypothesis. It's a thin hypothesis. What do I mean by that? It's capable of explaining my questions at a purely intellectual level. But it does nothing to answer my questions at other dimensions or registers of my human experience. It doesn't really help me understand my sense of awe. It does nothing to help me understand the thrill I have when I sense that God's hand is at work here in that really quite deep way. It doesn't satisfy my spiritual longings, my spiritual yearnings. It explains them, but it's what the philosopher Charles Taylor delivers. He says, he talks about the felt flatness of secularism. And I would say for me as a human being, what this delivers is a felt flatness of existence. It's a nice theory, it's just thin. And I just wonder whether, as a Christian, I can have my cake and eat it. Because as a theistic evolutionist, and I don't want to get into a debate about evolution, and I'm not going there, right? But if I were a theistic evolutionist, I can believe that these mechanisms that we're seeing here are part of the way that God built his world. That's how he built these aspects of our being in the world and our spiritual awareness into our brains. And they do have survival value, and they are part of what we inherit in our development, partially from the animal kingdom. But they're only part of it. And what we might want to do is to say that whilst natural selection has promoted pattern-seeking relationships and design for survival, God has built into our development these patterns for faith. After all, it would be surprising if he hadn't. What does the Bible say? He has also set eternity in the hearts of men. That's a very interesting phrase. The biblical concept of the heart is the whole person. It's the way we work. Do you remember Paul says, don't set your heart on this, set your heart on that. Paul sees the scriptures as the heart having an orientation to the world. It seeks out in the world the devices and desires of the heart, the deceitfulness of the heart. The heart is working at all kinds of levels, and the Bible teaches us that God has set eternity into the hearts of men. And all I'm saying is, what if part of his setting eternity is that we have developed seek relationships, to seek patterns, to seek design, because he is the great creator and designer of the world, and it connects us with that truth, because he is a God of coherence and beauty and symmetry and patterns. And he's given us the tools by which to discern his world. He is a God who loves to the end, and he's made us relational beings capable of deep love. And so these are simply the mechanisms, the means, the avenues by which he sets eternity into our hearts. And I'm not asking an atheist, I'm not trying to convince them, I'm just sharing with them an alternative hypothesis. But I'd want to contest that this is a thick hypothesis, because it not only explains the data at a strictly intellectual level, but it satisfies my own yearnings that there's a restlessness in the human heart that will only find its rest in God himself. And so it's in this thick hypothesis that I find both an intellectual explanation, but also a deeply spiritual and pleasing sense of meaning for which my heart seems to be built. So that I think is the way I personally handle this, this question. Human in the image of God, primed for relationship and meaning, equipped for wonder, appreciating a beauty, and by virtue of those things, made to rule, to design, to be rulers over, and to enter into the very design of God as we rule in and over and have dominion in his world.